Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. President Joe Biden formally announcing another 15 million barrels of oil will be released from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in December. It's aimed at lowering prices by adding oil supply. And the president calling on oil companies to pass along the savings and cut gasoline prices now and not keep the saved money themselves. Coming up, we'll hear from the president and House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, who says the president is responding to a political emergency. And we'll get analysis from Politico energy reporter Ben Lefebvre. Former Vice President Mike Pence says he is sure Republicans are going to win control of both the House and Senate after the midterm elections in a couple of weeks, and that his party does not need to choose between traditional conservatism and populism, perhaps a reference to former President Donald Trump. White House Director of Global Health Security and Biodefense discusses the new National Biodefense Strategy put out this week. Former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and First Lady Jill Biden at separate events talking about education policy and the role parents and communities have in making schools better. And in the war in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin declares martial law in the four Ukrainian regions that Russia has illegally annexed. We start with President Joe Biden at the White House announcing that release of the additional 15 million barrels of oil from the SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, in an effort to reduce gas prices. This release will fulfill a commitment that the president made in March to release 180 million barrels total from the SPR this year that followed Russia's invasion of Ukraine and gas prices going up. And it also now comes recently after the OPEC plus oil exporting countries announced they plan to reduce production, which will likely increase prices. Here's the president.
The Department of Energy will release another 15 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, extending our previously announced release through the month of December. Independent analysts have confirmed that drawdowns from the reserve so far have played a big role in bringing down oil prices, bringing them down. So we're going to continue to responsibly use that national asset. Right now, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is more than half full with about 400 million barrels of oil. That's more than enough for any emergency drawdown. With my announcement today, we're going to continue to stabilize markets and decrease the prices at a time when the actions of other countries have caused such volatility. And I've told my team behind me here to be prepared to look for further releases in the months ahead if needed. We're calling it a ready and release plan. This allows us to move quickly to prevent oil price spikes and respond to international events. Secondly, we need to responsibly increase American oil production without delaying or deferring our transition to clean energy. Let's debunk some myths here. My administration has not stopped or slowed U.S. oil production. Quite the opposite. We're producing 12 million barrels of oil per day. And by the end of this year, we will be producing 1 million barrels a day, more than the day in which I took office. In fact, we're on track for record oil production in 2023. And today, the United States is the largest producer of oil and petroleum products in the world. We export more than we import, and I've heard from oil companies that they're worried that investing in additional oil production today will, in case demand goes down in the future, and they're not going to be able to sell their oil products at a competitive price later. Well, we have a solution for that. Today, I'm announcing a plan to refill the Strategic Petroleum Oil Reserve in the years ahead at a profit for taxpayers. The United States government is going to purchase oil to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when prices fall to $70 a barrel. That means oil companies can invest to ramp up production now. With confidence, they'll be able to sell their oil to us at that price in the future, $70.
President Biden at the White House. The team that he mentioned standing behind him included the Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm and Brian Deese, Director of the White House National Economic Council. As we talk about barrels of oil, this from the Energy Information Administration, petroleum refineries in the United States produce about 19 to 20 gallons of motor gasoline and 11 to 12 gallons of ultra-low sulfur distillate fuel oil, most of which is sold as diesel fuel and in several states as heating oil, from one 42-gallon barrel of crude oil. Also, the U.S. uses about 20 million barrels of oil per day. More from the president. He says that he's taking a third step today, calling on oil companies to lower prices now.
I'm calling on oil companies to pass the savings on to consumers. Consider this. In the second quarter of this year, profits at six of the largest producers, publicly traded oil companies, were more than $70 billion. That's $70 billion in just one quarter, 90 days, $70 billion. So far, American oil companies are using that windfall, the windfall of profits, to buy back their own stock, passing that money on to their shareholders, not to consumers.
President Biden's full remarks run about 15 minutes. We covered them, and we have them at our website, cspan.org, in their entirety. After his prepared statement, as he was leaving the room, reporters asking him why he's taking action now.
What is your response to Republicans who say you are only doing this SPR release because, to help Democrats in the midterms?
Where have they been the last 4 months? That's my response.
Is it politically motivated, sir? This
no, move, it's not.
3 weeks before the midterms?
Look, it makes sense. I've been doing this for how long now? It's not politically motivated at all. It's motivated to make sure that I continue to push on what I've been pushing on. And that is making sure there's enough oil that's being pumped by the companies so that we have the ability to be able to produce enough gas that we need here at home, oil we need here at home, and at the same time, keep moving in the direction of providing for alternative energy. That's what I've been doing. Now, the problem is these guys are asleep. I don't know where they've been. And they seem, you know, the price at the pump should reflect what the price of a barrel of oil cost. And it's not going down consistently.
President Biden at the White House mid-afternoon. The White House actually previewed today's announcement with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve last night. So early this morning, the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy asked for a response on CNBC.
The Strategic Petroleum Oil Reserve was created to put us in a time of emergency. This is a political emergency to the Democrats. That is why he's using it. But he's already used it so far that it's down the lowest it's been in more than 40 years. If we were to have a hurricane in the Gulf or another emergency, we would not be prepared. He's already used one third of it. He's put America in jeopardy, just like he put America in jeopardy on the very first day when he has started attacking the energy industry. And believe me, I believe in all forms of energy. Every study, even coming out of the president, we're going to need 50% more going into the future for the next 25 years. So we need to expand our grid, expand our capability. That means all the above, not picking one form of energy and putting America in jeopardy.
But leader, I mean, Republicans also are very aware of how inflation is impacting, you know, people in the country. And is it a crisis? Is it the kind of crisis the SPR was actually designed for? Probably not. But when you have limited options, you can see, you know, why the president has decided to do that, to give some relief to individuals.
No, it's not why I see that. I mean, think about what the president just said the White House a few weeks ago, that he didn't ask Saudi Arabia. Then Saudi Arabia comes out and proves that the president lied. The president didn't ask Saudi Arabia not to cut production well into the future, just until the election is over. That's right. Pure political play. That's what he's doing here now. Why wouldn't he go to America, lift the LNG restrictions, lift the sanctions, what he's putting on for more leases, allow the development more, think long term? Why do we want to be dependent on another country? Why wouldn't we think not only America to be energy independent, but let's think long term? Why don't we make China dependent on American natural gas? If you're concerned about the environment, American natural gas is 41% cleaner than Russian natural gas. Why wouldn't we go about making America the individual that can sell around the world? More jobs in America, lower price that you can fill up your tank and have money left over, but also not only that America is stronger, but the world would be safer.
Congressman Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, the minority leader. On CNBC this morning, Politico Energy reporter Ben LaFave has been covering the president's announcement on the release of more barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He joins us now on the phone. Thank you. In one of your tweets, you call the sale of the 15 million barrels in December, a total of 180 million barrels this year, the mother of all SPR releases. What's been the effect on gas prices so far to give a sense of whether today's announcement will have an effect as well?
The effect of the original, I mean, I guess we have to start here. It's this, what was announced yesterday, the 15 million barrel release, is just the tail end of what the administration already authorized back in March. So it's a little bit anticlimactic. There were reporters on a background call with administration officials yesterday who were kind of like, what's the point of this announcement? You already made this. The administration said, well, we didn't have to do this last 15 million barrels. That you know, we had already authorized it, but that didn't mean we have to, you know, that did not mean we have to do it, but we're doing it. The original announcement back in March did have an effect on gasoline prices. I talked to some analysts today who are basically saying, rewind back to March of this year, and the oil industry was still grappling with trying to amp up production after, you know, COVID kind of gutted gasoline demand. We had Russia invading Ukraine at that time, and the oil market was a mess. So this kind of ginormous 180 million barrel release actually did have the impact of kind of calming markets and assuring refiners there would be oil supply available. So the administration will say, you know, hey, we brought prices down more than a dollar. I think the all-time nominal high was about $5.02 a gallon last June or so, as oil markets still roiled. And they'll say, you know, this release kind of helped us bring it down to like where we are now. Like, you know, I think it's like the national average is 3.87 or something. So it's around there. So it did do some good. This latest release or this latest announcement from folks I talked to, you know, they've said, look, it's just going to extend by 2 weeks by what the administration's already been doing for 5 months. So maybe a little bit of a minimal impact from this one.
The president also announcing today that he plans to buy back oil when it reaches about $70 a barrel. He says that that's good for oil companies. They'll make a profit. It's good for taxpayers. They'll pay less than they would have. And it'll spur investment in oil production. Will that happen? Will it all happen?
It might. I mean, one of the things that the oil industry has been doing is not expanding production very much. We've kind of plateaued at around 12 million barrels a day of oil production in the U.S. That's much higher than it had been when the pandemic kind of had gutted everything. But it's still not to the level that we had been at pre-pandemic. And the oil industry is saying, look, we don't want to put out more rigs if, people are, you know, buying more EVs or there's just less demand for oil in general. So what the administration is saying today is, you know, we'll be a, you know, buyer of last resort. If you want to sell to us to restock the SPR, you know, restock the reserve, if prices reach $70 a barrel, you know, you will have a market there. It'll be us. So they're hoping that'll kind of give the industry, you know, a little shove to kind of maybe increase production at least a little bit, you know, in the medium, shorter medium term. And it could happen. I talked to analysts today who said, you know, it's not, you know, that maybe the long-term guarantee the industry wants, but it might be enough to kind of like tide them over, you know, for at least the next couple of years.
We're talking with Ben LaFave from Politico. Every time there's a release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, there's a debate about the definition of emergency. Whether an economic emergency qualifies. Does it qualify? What's the legal part of this?
There's no legal part. I mean, the SBR has been a piggy bank for both parties for a while. I mean, I was just talking to a colleague, those listeners with long memories may remember that The Trump administration, in its first proposed budget, wanted a release, I think it was of 250 million barrels of SPR oil. They just wanted the money to do other things with it. Congress didn't go that far, but the Republicans at that time, when they made the budget, did, you know, authorize, I think it was 100 million barrel release, again, just for the use of funds. Analysts I've talked to think that the original authorization of 180 million barrels back in March from the Biden administration probably came at a time that did warrant, you know, it being called an emergency. I mean, this is when, you know, prices were starting to go to $142 a barrel, I think it was, or maybe $120 a barrel. It was pretty high. And, you know, that had, if it hadn't been, if just the market hadn't been calmed at that time, then who knows where prices were going to go. I mean, some, you know, banks like Goldman Sachs kind of usually did do their, you know, prices could go to $200 a barrel, you know, if things don't turn around, you know, reports at that time. Again, it's as it's kind of drawn out, you know, prices have stabilized, have come back down, and people have thought, you know, we don't need to keep doing this. It doesn't matter. This is just, you know, the big critique is that, you know, this is just a political response to OPEC earlier this month saying it was going to cut production. Its own, you know, oil production. So this time seems to be less of an emergency and more of, you know, political maneuvering. But again, this was already, this release was already authorized, you know, 7 months ago.
Ben LaFave is a energy reporter with Politico. Find his stories at politico.com and on Twitter. He's at BJ LaFave, LeFebvre. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, the Dow down 99, NASDAQ down 91, and S&P down 24. Former Vice President Mike Pence today talking about the future of conservatism and this year's elections. And as TheHill.com reports it, he warned conservatives against veering too far toward unprincipled populism, delivering a speech with several veiled swipes at former President Trump's fixation on the 2020 election and grip on the party. That's how The Hill put it. Mike Pence saying that conservatism is bigger than any one moment, any one election, any one person. It's about ideas. C-SPAN covered this program.
Some in our movement long for a simple return to traditional conservative agenda of the Reagan era. Others say our movement should be swept along by a new and energetic sense of populism. I truly do believe that we don't have to choose between one at the expense of another. After all, I believe the agenda of the Trump-Pence administration was a marriage of an unapologetic commitment to the foundations of the conservative agenda with thoughtful populist priorities driven by the aspirations of the American people. I'm proud to report during the 4 years of our administration, every single day, we fought for a strong national defense, for free market and free enterprise principles, less government, less taxes, less regulation, and we stood every day for the sanctity of human life. But in our administration, we also heeded the call of the American people. We recognize that border security is national security. We recognize that trade must be free and fair. And we changed the national consensus. And now today in America, the vast majority of the people of this country accept that China is the greatest threat to our security and prosperity in the 21st century. So today, on the cusp of a new era of Republican leadership for conservatives in this moment in history, I think we need to chart a course that doesn't veer off too far in either direction. Our movement cannot forsake the foundational commitment that we have to security, to limited government, to liberty, and to life. But nor can we allow our movement to be led astray by the siren song of unprincipled populism that's unmoored from our oldest traditions and most cherished values. Let me say, this movement and the party that it animates must remain the movement of a strong national defense, limited government, and traditional moral values and life.
Former Republican Vice President Mike Pence, a potential 2024 presidential candidate today at the Heritage Foundation. The White House responding to the release of police body camera footage in Florida showing arrests of people charged with voter fraud. The video was obtained by the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald. The arrest took place in August. The video released this week. Here is about a minute of it.
Apparently, I guess you have a warrant.
For what?
I'm not sure.
It's for voter stuff, man.
For voters.
I think the agents with FDLE talked to you last week about some voter fraud, voter stuff, when you weren't supposed to be voting, maybe.
I didn't.
So.
What are they talking about?
We're not the case agents, but what you got to do, they have reduced your bond quite a bit. It's two felony charges for voter fraud, but they've reduced it to $500 bonds. So it's $1,000 total.
Oh, my God, man. What?
So, yes, sir. So, unfortunately, right now, we're going to have to take you to jail.
Wow, man. Why are they doing this to me?
That's what you're
getting at. I didn't do nothing to nobody, man. Voter fraud. What is voter fraud?
Voting when you're not supposed to, sir, is what our understanding of the point is. Because of your sex offender status, you're not supposed to be voting.
You don't have a non-support warrant.
I don't know this.
What the fraud?
Let's walk over to my car, okay?
Why is y'all doing this now and this happened years ago?
I don't know. I have no idea, man.
It's a video of police body cams in Florida during arrests in August. The video obtained by the Tampa Bay Times, Miami Herald, and released this week. Turns out back in August, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, did announce these arrests during a news conference.
The state of Florida has charged and is in the process of arresting 20 individuals across the state for voter fraud. Now, the majority of these people illegally voted in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade. These folks voted illegally in this case, and there's going to be other grounds for other prosecutions in the future. They are disqualified from voting because they've been convicted of either murder or sexual assault, and they do not have the right to vote.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at a news conference in mid-August. That was from CBS Miami. Again, the video from the police body cams of the arrest just going public this week. Questions today to the White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
I'm wondering if you have a response to these videos first published by the Tampa Bay Times this week that show people in Florida who had been convicted of murder or sex offenses being released from prison, apparently thought they had the right to vote and have now been arrested for doing so.
Yeah, we have seen those videos. We have seen that reporting by publication that you just mentioned. I want to be careful because I don't want to weigh in on any specifics ongoing cases in Florida. But the president believes that people who are not incarcerated for a felony should have their voting rights restored automatically. And he has repeatedly called on the Senate to pass comprehensive voting rights legislation that would do just that.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre during her briefing in the White House briefing room today. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' office says that voter fraud in the state punishable by a $5,000 fine up to 5 years in prison. And a story at Axios has this. Florida state law does not allow people convicted of murder or felony sex offenses to vote after completing their sentence. A 2018 state amendment restored the right to vote for many felons, but not that specific group. This has created massive confusion among Florida residents, with many residents saying nobody told them they couldn't vote. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which is available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A discussion today about the Biden administration's new National Biodefense Strategy, which was released on Tuesday. An article at DefenseOne.com explaining that the strategy is intended to help protect the United States from future biological threats and mitigate the effect of pandemics and communicable diseases. Also, this from the article, as part of that strategy, the administration is requesting $88 billion in pandemic preparedness over the course of the next 5 years, in part to fund new research to predict outbreaks before they become pandemics, accelerate rapid testing to get ahead of where viruses are moving, and to bring the timeline for developing vaccines down to 3 months. The special assistant to President Biden and senior director for global health security and biodefense is Dr. Raj Panjabi. He was at CSIS today about the new strategy and how it compares to previous plans.
First of all, it puts a vision forward that we can create a world free of pandemics and other catastrophic biological incidents by really focusing on five key concrete actions. One is to prevent. That is to ensure early warning for biological threats. Second is to ensure that we prevent the spread of biological threats. And the third is to ensure we're prepared to reduce the impact should we have another pandemic, another epidemic, that we're prepared to reduce the impact on people, on communities. The fourth is to focus on rapidly responding when we do have these outbreaks and also other biological incidents, and doing that equitably. And the last is action, the fifth, is really to ensure we're helping communities, the economy, the environment recover when these events happen. So that's the outline of the plan. We can get into more details about what that practically means, I imagine, shortly. But you asked about what's different from both 2018 and the last time there was a National Biodefense Strategy, and what is also different from the American Pandemic Preparedness Plan that we released last year. So let me comment briefly on both of those. So first of all, from 2018, those five areas are actually pretty similar that I just described: to detect, to prevent, to prepare, to respond, to recover. And that's because the discipline of fighting biological threats is actually becoming, I think, more and more clearer. Mm-hmm. What's different is that within each of those, we've described a set of concrete, bold targets, such as ensuring we have vaccines available within 100 days of a new pandemic, such as ensuring we have greater investments in health workers across this country, and ensuring that we support other countries around the world to develop their capacities to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious diseases. There are more concrete and bold targets, number one. Number two, there is clarity. You mentioned over 20 federal agencies helped develop this plan. Each of them have also put themselves on the record for which one will be in charge of each one of those targets. So every target has a lead federal agency and then several support federal agencies. The third big difference is the advent of the National Security Memorandum 15, which places through the National Security Advisor, the White House in charge of the federal policy and coordination around biodefense, and the number of associated activities in that. Number one, that federal agencies will commit to, as the president has now ordered, provide reports against those targets on a quarterly basis. What's going well? What isn't going well? Also, ensuring that the Office of Management and Budget provides the ability for us to assess how much funding is being requested, whether that's enough to meet the targets, and in consultation with the NSC, the National Security Council, the ability to help federal agencies refine that. There are a number of other pieces, but essentially it's trying to integrate and hold accountable the biodefense enterprise.
Dr. Raj Panjabi is Special Assistant to President Biden and Senior Director for Global Health Security and Biodefense. Today, speaking at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, he says that National Biodefense Strategy released this week is not only aimed at dealing with outbreaks once they are circulating among the population, such as COVID, Ebola, monkeypox, or polio, but also preventing accidental laboratory leaks of viruses and stopping the possible use of viruses as weapons by countries or non-state actors. The White House COVID-19 response coordinator, Dr. Ashish Jha, also talking about pandemics today, both the status of COVID-19 and lessons learned to be applied in the future. He was at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C.
I'm trying to think of another time in history where you had this massive of an outbreak around the world of a virus, and we were vaccinating billions of people at the same time.
Yeah, it's never happened.
It's never happened. No. It creates all sorts of interesting dynamics, but what it does most importantly is it puts a ton of evolutionary pressure on the virus to evolve away from from the immunity wall that has been built up around the world. And you get a large enough set of infections, you get enough virus out there, and you're going to see mutations. And that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing rapid evolution. I think a lot of virologists that I talk to on a regular basis have described it as sort of breathtaking how quickly this virus is evolving. I think about the fact that I started my job about 6.5, 7 months ago. And at that point, we were seeing this rise of BA2. Just in the last 6, 7 months, we saw that fall off and 2.12 take over, then BA4 and 5 take over. And now we're seeing these subvariants, BQ11, BQ1, XBB. I could bore you with alphabet soup all day. But the point is, it's breathtaking. Like, it's really amazing how much variation we're seeing. A couple of key things to understand. One is our immunity is very robust, and our ability, our T-cell ability to, like, identify and deal with these variants, especially if you've had multiple vaccine doses or if you've been vaccinated and have had prior infections, is quite robust. So I remain convinced that we are not heading to a period of time again where we're going to see 3,000-4,000 deaths a day. Like, something very extraordinary would need to happen, and I can't even quite figure out what that is.
Yeah.
That said, because of the rapid viral evolution, if we do not keep up, if we take a pure laissez-faire, like, I got vaccinated last year, I got infected in January, I'll be good, we're going to see a pretty significant wave of infections, right? Because these are highly immune-evasive. So our job is keep up with the virus, updated vaccines, keep up with the virus, updated treatments, or make sure the treatments continue to work. And then, as Julie said, one of the challenges in this pandemic has been information and good communication. Communicate clearly with the American people what they need to do to protect themselves as we get in the fall and winter. I think if we stay up with that, the virus is wily, so is the scientific community.
It is.
Our ability to respond to it is, like, not to be underestimated.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the White House COVID-19 response coordinator today at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington. You mentioned Dr. Julie Gerberding, former director at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, joining him. The current average of new COVID-19 cases in the U.S., according to the CDC website, is about 30,000 per day, and the deaths about 300 per day. This from CNN. The Food and Drug Administration on Wednesday authorized Novavax's COVID-19 vaccine for use as a first booster dose among adults 18 and older, at least 6 months after completing a primary COVID-19 vaccine series. Previously, the Novavax vaccine was used only as a two-dose series. It is the fourth coronavirus vaccine available in the U.S. Unlike the others, it uses a protein-based technology. COVID-19 pandemic and its lasting effects on the education system in the United States came up today at two events that C-SPAN covered, one with First Lady Jill Biden, the other with Betsy DeVos, former education secretary during the Donald Trump presidency. First, Jill Biden, she was at a Communities in Schools Leadership Town Hall Conference in Washington. That group, Communities in Schools, describes itself as a national organization that supports 2,900 schools across 26 states and the District of Columbia by connecting students with community resources. Here's the First Lady.
And after the disruptions of the pandemic, your work has become even more important. Whether it's organizing a school food pantry or setting up after-school tutoring or working with the community to bring in doctors and counselors and health specialists, you're giving families the support they need to thrive. And our administration is here to help with your efforts. We safely reopened schools and are addressing the academic and mental health needs of our students. We're providing funding to hire more mental health professionals and create wraparound support. And I'm sure that you've all seen this. I mean, I know I'm seeing it in my classroom this past year, how much students need help with mental health. And with partners like CIS, the Biden-Harris administration launched the National Partnership for Student Success to help increase the number of tutors and mentors in our schools. I mean, I truly believe in mentoring and the power of those connections with our kids. I do it at my school, at Nova. This work doesn't help families. It's crucial for supporting educators as well. When we lighten the burden on teachers, they can do what they do best: teach, counsel, create, and inspire. In fact, educators tell us when CIS services are in their schools, they are better able to improve student achievement and get more satisfaction from the work that they do. Thank you.
First Lady Jill Biden at today's leadership conference in Washington, D.C., of that organization, Communities in Schools. The group says it's their first in-person conference in 2 years because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who served during the Trump administration, also talking about schools post-COVID-19 pandemic and how parental interest and involvement has changed. Secretary DeVos was at a summit in Bentonville, Arkansas, hosted by the group America Strong and Free.
I absolutely think that parents are going to continue to be much more involved. They had a wake-up call the last 2 years, and many parents who thought their children were doing very well in the schools that they chose to have them in, whether it was moving to a suburban district with a good school or wherever else, they suddenly realized that they did not have quite as much influence or say over what actually happened with their children. And many of them saw, just a lack of rigor when they were doing the distance learning. Even that which was fairly well executed, I think they were surprised at the lack of expectation and aspiration. And so this is a really, really good moment in time to ensure that policies that are passed are going to support families' ability to drive their children's education. I think parents realize like never before how little say they ultimately have had, and they're not happy about that. And I would add to that, I think this is also a good moment for teachers, because I think a lot of teachers also were very frustrated with how the system dealt with the last couple of years. And I think we're going to, with more and more education freedom, I think we're going to see more and more great teachers who have gone to the sidelines come back on the field and engage when they have more ability to also control the environment in which they are teaching and participating. And, I did two roundtables while I was in office with teachers who had been teachers of the year in their state or their district. And very soon after they'd done their year victory lap, had gone back to their classrooms, and within a few months had quit teaching. And I wanted to know why. These were clearly very talented, capable individuals, and yet they had left what they loved doing. And almost to a person, it was, I had my moment in the sun. I thought I could go back and add more to my school, my environment. I thought I had more to bring and more to offer. And I was basically told, you've had your moment, get back in the box. Oh, by the way, be on page 32 of the textbook on this day. And they got frustrated and left. And I think there are lots of those kinds of individuals out there that can come back out on the field and participate.
Former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, she served during the Donald Trump administration, today at a summit in Bentonville, Arkansas. It was hosted by the group America Strong and Free, that group created by Arkansas Governor Republican Asa Hutchinson. Betsy DeVos on a panel on education along with Arizona Governor Doug Ducey and former Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam, also both Republicans. You can find the full video of that discussion at our website, cspan.org. On Russia's invasion of Ukraine, this from Associated Press in Kyiv, Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered martial law on Wednesday for four illegally annexed Ukrainian regions, doubling down on a faltering invasion he described as very difficult. In a tacit acknowledgement that another stinging battlefield defeat may be unfolding, his forces organized evacuations of citizens from one of the first major cities they seized. With Ukrainian counteroffensive grinding towards Kherson, the battle for the southern city of more than 250,000 people, industries, and a major port is a pivotal moment for Ukraine and Russia heading into winter, when front lines could become largely frozen for months. That from Associated Press. President Joe Biden asked about this today at the White House.
There's martial law in parts of Ukraine. What does that say to you, sir, about where his thinking is on the war in Ukraine right now?
I think that Vladimir Putin finds himself in an incredibly difficult position. And what it reflects to me is it seems his only tool available to him is to brutalize individual citizens in Ukraine, Ukrainian citizens, to try to intimidate them into capitulating. They're not going to do that.
President Biden at the White House. From CNN, Iran has sent military personnel to Russian-occupied territory inside Crimea to train and advise the Russian military on the use of Iranian-built drones that Moscow has used to devastating effect in its war in Ukraine, according to two sources familiar with U.S. intelligence. Iran denies it's sending Russia the drones, let alone the trainers, but the United States, United Kingdom, and France say that they are, and doing so violates a United Nations resolution, the one that codified the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. More on this from today's State Department briefing with the principal deputy spokesperson, Vedant Patel.
There's a Security Council meeting today. Can you explain what the United States is looking for with this? What would be the consequences for, as you say, violations of these of Resolution 2231?
Thanks, Sean. So I don't want to get ahead of any potential actions or things that could come from a Security Council meeting. But to your question, yes, the U.S. will join the British and French in raising this issue at a closed meeting where the Security Council will hear from an expert briefer on the transfer of UAVs from Iran to Russia. As we've seen over the course of the past months, there has ample evidence that Russia is using UAVs from Iran in cruel and deliberate attacks against the people of Ukraine, including against civilians and critical civilian infrastructure. We will convey these grave concerns about Russia's acquisition of these UAVs from Iran in clear violation of UN Security Council 2231. But I don't have any specific actions to preview just yet.
Could you say whether the so-called snapback of sanctions is something that you would support a return of or some further UN sanctions in response to this?
Again, I don't want to get ahead of this process and get ahead of our meetings and engagements with our partners in New York.
So just one more thing on that: the European Union is readying some sanctions on regarding the drone transfer. Do you have any comment on that? Is that something that's been coordinated with the U.S.? Are you hopeful for other countries also?
So we have been coordinating closely with the EU, but I'm not going to get into the details of those diplomatic discussions. But, we have been warning about these transfers since July, and we would welcome the EU sanctioning Iran for supplying weapons to Russia. And we are aware of reports that the EU is considering these actions. And also, I would again note and reiterate that the United States itself continues to have tools at its disposal that are practical, that are aggressive, that are useful in holding Iran accountable. And you have seen us take those actions as it relates to Iranian malign activity.
Vedant Patel is the State Department's principal deputy spokesperson, taking reporters' questions today at the State Department in Washington. Now to Great Britain and the continuing upheaval in its new government. Home Secretary Suella Braverman resigning today after just 43 days on the job. This was after she admitted she violated a government rule about sending written statements through a personal email. She did so to another member of parliament. She admitted it, and the Prime Minister, Liz Truss, did ask for her resignation. But in the resignation letter, so Ellen Braverman taking a bit of a swipe at the Prime Minister, writing, "The business of government relies upon people accepting responsibility for their mistakes, pretending we haven't made mistakes, carrying on as if everyone can't see that we have made them, and hoping that things will magically come right is not serious politics." Earlier in the day, during Prime Minister's question time, here's the exchange between the Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and opposition leader Keir Starmer.
"Mr. Speaker, the only mandate she's ever had is from members opposite. Yeah. It was a mandate built on fantasy economics, yeah, and it ended in disaster. Yeah. The country's got nothing to show for it except the destruction of the economy, yeah, and the implosion of the Tory party. Yeah. I've got the list here. 45p tax cut, gone. Yeah. Corporation tax cut, gone. 20p tax cut, gone. 2-year energy freeze, gone. Tax-free shopping, gone. Economic credibility, gone. And her supposed best friend, the former Chancellor, he's gone as well. They're all gone. So why is she still here?"
Mr. Speaker, I am a fighter and not a quitter. I have acted in the national interest to make sure that we have economic stability.
Prime Minister, order. Order. I'm going to hear the Prime Minister. I suggest that all members need to hear the answer. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I am a fighter and not a quitter. Delivered on the energy price guarantee. Yes. We've delivered on the energy price guarantee. We've delivered on national insurance. We are going to deliver to stop the militant trade unions disrupting our railways. The Honourable Gentleman has no idea. He has no plan and he has no alternative.
The British Prime Minister Liz Truss of the Conservative Party getting questions from the opposition leader Keir Starmer of the Labour Party during Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons. Reuters has a story from London that begins, "The biggest jump in food prices since 1980 pushed British inflation back into double digits last month, matching a 40-year high hit in July in a new blow for households grappling with a cost of living crisis." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories that Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.